Extraordinary staff at South Dakota Public Broadcasting. You see a few of the gentlemen here. We have a truck out back. There are many more out there. It's the same staff that we go to basketball tournaments with, we go to jazz concerts with, and we're very pleased to be here tonight for this special evening with a special guest and a very special introduction to that guest. Would you welcome Matt R. McGovern?
I want to thank you all for coming out tonight to support South Dakota Public Broadcasting. And I want to thank South Dakota Public Broadcasting for inviting me to be a part of this event tonight, especially Teresa Spencer, who called me one afternoon when I was at work and I was in the middle of something really busy. And she said, "Hi, this is Teresa from Friends of South Dakota Public Broadcasting." So I immediately tried to get rid of her because I thought it was a fundraising call. And so just let that be a lesson to you. Be nice to these people when they call you. They're doing great things for South Dakota, like putting on these programs tonight and the programming that this event is about, Ken Burns' new documentary, The War. And so a lot of times people ask me, what's it like to be related to Senator McGovern? What's it like to be the grandson of someone who's accomplished so much, someone who was elected to Congress, someone who is a war hero, someone who has served to represent South Dakota in the U.S. Senate, ran for president, all these great things. And I would say, well, we're really proud of all those things, but to us, he's just Grandpa George. And so we were really lucky, even if he had not accomplished all these things, we'd be really lucky because of the type of people that my grandparents are and were. We always enjoyed going to visit them so much in Washington, D.C. when I was growing up. We would do all the same things that any other family would do. We'd, Grandpa George would take us to the zoo, or we'd go to movies. We'd go, have these big family meals where Grandma Eleanor'd be cooking Thanksgiving dinner and we'd be watching a football game. So all those kind of things that any family would do. And they would both talk about the old days. Both my grandparents would. And Grandpa George would talk a lot about growing up in Mitchell, being on the debate team in high school, or what it was like to meet my grandma when they were both freshmen at DWU. And they talk about hard times in the 30s when everybody was struggling economically. The whole country was in the Great Depression. So he'd talk a lot about the old days, and we'd love hearing those stories about the good times and the bad. But one thing that was really hard to get him to do would be to talk about World War II. And that was not something that he did very often. And most of the stories that I heard about his accomplishments in World War II, I heard secondhand through my mom or my dad, and I heard more of them a couple years ago when Stephen Ambrose wrote the book about him called Wild Blue. So, I didn't really get it when I was a kid, because you watch these movies and these documentaries, and it looks really exciting and cool, all this stuff that went on back then, and it would look like he would have a lot to brag about, and so it didn't make sense to me why he wouldn't talk more about these things. And of course, as I got older, I understood a little better that for him to be telling these stories, he'd have to be talking about times that he was almost killed, or times that good friends of his were killed, or times that they had a successful mission, which meant a lot of people on the ground got killed, and it was just part of doing the job of defeating the Nazis. So I can see now why he wouldn't want to talk about these things so much, especially to a little kid. So we're all really lucky tonight to be able to hear these stories, and you all are probably going to hear some things that even people in my family haven't heard too much about. So we're all really lucky tonight. And so, Grandpa, we're going to introduce you. Usually you have these great titles, either senator or lieutenant or congressman. But tonight, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to introduce Grandpa George.
Couldn't have been better. Thank you.
Senator, thank you for being our guest here this evening.
Well, it's my pleasure, as my grandson said a moment ago, we're all in the debt of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I've enjoyed it for so many years. You didn't ask me to make a plug, but I do it out of admiration and genuine appreciation for the high quality of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. It's an objective and fair source of the news. It sets cultural standards that are at the top. It's just a resource here in South Dakota, the state we all love.
Thank you very much. It's very nice of you to say.
Thank you. I'm still a little emotional about my grandson's introduction here. He's a lawyer here in Rapid City now. I'm probably going to borrow money from him.
Let's talk about the World War II era. As a young man growing up in Mitchell, coming through the 1930s, the dawn of the 1940s, war was looming. What was the atmosphere like for you and for the community? What were people thinking?
Well, even as a high school student at Mitchell High School, especially in my last 2 years, 1939 and 1940, I thought we should get ready to take on Hitler. I thought the guy was a madman. So did my history teacher at Mitchell High School. And I was impatient that we hadn't entered that war sooner. As you know, we really didn't get into the heavy fighting until after the war had been on for several years. And I was an internationalist then, as I am today, and I thought that we ought to be involved in stopping these three Axis powers members, Tojo in Japan, Mussolini in Italy, and most of all Hitler in Germany. He was literally a madman, a genius, but sometimes geniuses can go mad, and I thought he was a threat to Western civilization. So when I finally got a chance to volunteer, I volunteered for the Army Air Corps and went on to become a bomber pilot. I had a crew of 10 young guys. I looked at the list when they told me who my crew was going to be. I was then about 20. And I said to Elner, gosh, here's an engineer on this crew who's 33 years old. An old man like that is not going to listen to me. So I grew a mustache and I let my hair grow and I tried to look as sober and as serious as I could. It turns out that the engineer, Mike Valco, was the easiest guy on the crew to handle. But the rest of them were 19, 20 years of age. I eventually got to be 22 before the war ended. But I couldn't wait to get into that war. I thought then, and I think today, all these years later, that it was absolutely essential for the United States to be involved in that conflict.
Were your thoughts at that time, was it connected at all, the fact that you became part of the civil pilot training program in 1940?
Well, that's true. There, I was a freshman at Dakota Wesleyan, and there was a fellow freshman from Custer, South Dakota, by the name of Norman Ray, probably the best looking guy on campus. And he had a passion to become a pilot. And he discovered that the government had a program called CPT, Civilian Pilot Training. And if a college could get 10 people 10 men, but they took women too if they wanted to be pilots. 10 people in that college would sign up for pilot training. The government would provide an instructor, an airplane, and an airfield. Mitchell already had an airfield. And so I was one of the 10 that Norman Ray recruited. I was scared to death the first time I opened the throttle on that thing and took off down the runway. But after 8 hours of instruction, you had to solo. I said to the instructor, I said, Cliff, I can't, I'm not ready to solo. He said, you're as ready as you'll ever be. Get your tail into that plane and you're going to solo today. So I took off. I got it in the air, and I flew over Lake Mitchell, and I located the Corn Palace, and I even thought I located my house in Mitchell, and I got it back down on the ground in one piece. So from that time on, I was hooked on flying. I wasn't yet signed up for the war, but I suppose that's one of the reasons I signed up for the Army Air Corps. There wasn't any Army Air Force. I mean, there wasn't any Air Force then. There was the Army Air Corps and the Navy Air Corps. They were later united. But it's interesting, when we finally decided to sign up for service, the 10 of us, we went to Omaha, where they had both the Navy Air Corps recruiting and the Army Air Corps recruiting. And one of the 10 guys I was with picked up a rumor after we reached Omaha that if you joined or you went to the Army Air Corps recruiting office, they'd give you a free meal ticket to an Omaha cafeteria. So on the strength of that unsubstantiated rumor and a meal ticket, it was probably worth about $1, all 10 of us joined the Army Air Corps. So that's the careful, considered, scientific way that I decided to be an Army Air Corps pilot.
The obvious follow-up is, what was for dinner?
It wasn't bad. That would have been 1941, mm-hmm. I guess.
You know, there are dates in all of our lives we remember exactly where we were at the time. What was your December 7th, 1941 like?
Well, I lived in Mitchell, so the fact that I was going to Dakota Wesleyan meant that I lived at home and would walk a mile every day to the college. And they had a course there that was required of all freshmen. It was a course called Music Appreciation. It was taught by a brilliant violinist by the name of Bob Brown, a graduate of the Eastman School of Music. Wesleyan had a great music school in those days. And we had to write a critique every week on the New York Philharmonic. They put on a Sunday conference. And we had to write a critique. Imagine us 18 and 19-year-old pups trying to critique the New York Philharmonic. But we'd write things like, I think on this part of the piece there should have been a little more string instruments, you know, baloney like that. And we'd turn those things in. We didn't know what we were doing, but I'll tell you something. We all learned to love music. That, of course, was the course. Anyway, I was watching them and listening, not watching because there was no television in those days. I was listening on Sunday to this New York Philharmonic. They were playing some music from Mozart, probably one of the pure geniuses in human history. And all of a sudden, the announcer broke in and said, we must interrupt this program. Air units and naval units of the Japanese fleet have bombed Pearl Harbor and destroyed all these ships. And so I didn't have a glimmer of where Pearl Harbor was, nor did I know that we owned it. But in any event, I could tell by watching my dad's face that this was serious. And by the end of the afternoon, I'd made up my mind I would be involved in what I was sure to be the American reaction to this attack.
Well, even though you signed up shortly thereafter, it seems that the Army Air Corps wasn't ready for you, and actually being called into the service was nearly a year later.
That's true. They didn't have enough airplanes. They didn't have enough instructors. They didn't have enough landing fields. So I stayed at Dakota Wesleyan for another year waiting to be called.
Do you remember that day when the orders arrived?
I do indeed. I was a member of their debating team. My dad, who was a great baseball player in his day, always discouraged my brother and me from going out for athletics. He said, go out for the glee club and learn how to sing. Go out for the debate squad, the oratory team, and learn how to speak on your feet. And he put so much pressure on us, I decided to do that. So I was glad to have a little additional time at Wesleyan to add another year to my schooling. It meant that when the war was over, I only had about 1 year to go. And I talked to him, I feel almost guilty yet telling you this, but I talked the dean, who was a kindly old man, into giving me a half a year's academic credit for my years in the Air Force. And I told him how I had studied meteorology, air mechanics, navigation. All of this is true. It wasn't entirely a fraudulent act on my part, but it bordered on it. But anyway, I got a half a year's credit for that, so I finished at Wesleyan in 6 months after the war, and then I enrolled under the GI Bill at Northwestern and went all the way through to a PhD in history.
Do you remember that call-up? You were called to Missouri for mm-hmm. basic training?
Yeah. Jefferson Barracks, Missouri, in February.
Sergeant Trumbo?
Sergeant Trumbo. He was an old career Army sergeant, and he looked on us as a bunch of spoiled college boys. And he would sometimes say, listen, you damn college boys, now get your ass in gear here, and let's do this thing right. And he'd yell at us, and but after 60 days of that, I loved that guy. I think he prepared us in a way that set the stage for our service in World War II. Jefferson Barracks at that time was a pretty grim place. We had various streets we'd call Influenza Valley, Pneumonia Gulch, various things like that, because everybody came down with various viruses and flus and cold. It was a bitter time. You know, one of the highlights, though, there's always good that comes out of things. One of the highlights, I got kind of homesick one night, and I went into St. Louis all alone, got the Army bus, and they dropped me off at a busy intersection in downtown St. Louis, and I discovered it was the St. Louis Opera House. And I hardly got my bearings before an usher came running out of the building, and he said, son, would you like to stand on the stage tonight with Marian Anderson? And I said, are you kidding? He says, no, she wants somebody from each of the services. She's got a Navy guy and an Army guy and a Marine, but nobody from the Air Force. Would you be willing to join? I couldn't wait to get on that stage, and for the next hour, we stood as close to her while she did that concert as I am to you. I thought it was the most wonderful voice I'd ever heard. So that was the best thing that came out of Jefferson Barracks.
Well, from there, after basic, then you finally began to train to fly. It started with ground school, and you were back at a university in Illinois.
Yeah, there again, They didn't really know what to do with us. They just didn't have the personnel to start training pilots, so they sent us back to school. I was sent to the University of Southern Illinois in Carbondale, Illinois, and I stayed there for, I think, 4.5 or 5 months in ground school, and that's where we learned navigation, meteorology, aircraft mechanics, all these other things. That's what I cashed in on back at Westland. But I thoroughly enjoyed those months. There was a Methodist minister there who had a beautiful big church in Carbondale by the name of Harvey, M.L. Harvey, big overweight fellow, but he loved singing, and he recruited about 75 of us Air Force cadets to sing in his choir. And we weren't bad. He had a choir director, a marvelous young woman, and she turned us into a pretty good chorus. That was another nice thing about Carbondale that I'd have missed if they'd have been ready to start training us to fly.
Well, after ground school, it was time to learn to fly, moving on to Coffeyville, Kansas. But your life also changed, and so did your relationship with Eleanor about that same time.
Well, we were dating for 2 years in college, and we knew we were going to get married, but we decided it should wait until after the war. Eleanor's father was pushing that very hard. he thought I might not come back from the war. That's why Eleanor wanted to hurry up and get the marriage. I tried to be neutral on that and let Eleanor and her dad fight that out. Anyway, we finally said, well, let's get married when I get my wings. I'd then be a second lieutenant and I'd have my wings. And then we got to thinking, well, why wait until I get my wings, you know, why not get married in beginning training at Muskogee, Oklahoma. So we decided on that. I hitchhiked home and got in there about 2 o'clock in the morning, and we got married the next day. My dad presided. He was, as I said, a Methodist minister. We got married in the little Methodist Church in Woonsocket, which was Eleanor's hometown. By the way, did you notice that with the Hillary Clinton and some other members of Congress are going to name that Woonsocket post office the Eleanor McGovern post office? If I can divert here a minute, I said to one of my friends, you know, Eleanor always got the upbeat publicity, and I always got the rough end of it, and here it's still going on. She's in another land now, but she gets a post office named after her the same day my car was stolen. And that's, so my headline is McGovern's car. I said, it's just like it always is. But anyway, we got married in Muskogee. In Mitchell, there was no time for a honeymoon. They only gave me 2 days off, and I spent one of them getting home and another one getting back. And so we got on a dirty, smoky old train in Mitchell about 10 o'clock at night, the day of the wedding, and the train was jammed. Soldiers, young wives, little children, crying kids. There was no place to sit. We sat on our suitcase from Mitchell to Kansas City, and we got off there to change to another train from there to Muskogee, Oklahoma, and I was at the ticket counter getting the new ticket issued. And we had everything we owned in one suitcase, including what few wedding gifts we had. And I set it down while I paid the ticket collector, and somebody stole it. And so we got on that train. We had to run to make the train. And we got on the train and we sat down on this train. There were chairs, I mean, there were seats to sit in. And I noticed Eleanor's lip was quivering. I looked at this little girl, and both of us just broke down and cried about this. But that was an unfortunate beginning of marriage. But it got a little better after that. Anyway, it lasted 63 years.
Do you have some things to share about learning to fly the BT-13, the A-17, and finally getting behind the wheel of a B-24? Tell us about flight training.
Well, in primary school at Muskogee, we flew the PT-19. It was built by Fairchild, wonderful airplane. It was an open cockpit, the pilot in the front cockpit and the student in the rear. I loved that airplane. Incidentally, about 2 years ago, I was in Florida staying with a friend of mine for a couple of days. Eleanor was with me at that time. And he said, what kind of plane did you learn to fly? And I said, well, after the little single engine plane in Mitchell, I flew a PT-19. You probably never heard of him. He said, I got one out in my hangar. It's a town called Lexington, Florida. And there's a big roadway down the middle. On this side, everybody has an airplane. On this side, everybody has a boat. You know, these Floridians live it up. And so if you lived on the left side, you just you landed your plane and just taxied around, put it in the hangar, just like it was your car. And so he said, would you like to fly it? I said, well, I haven't flown since World War II. He says, well, I'll bet you can do it. I'll get in with you. Well, believe this or not, I took that thing off and flew it around as though I'd never been away from it. I didn't think I'd know a thing about flying, but it's like playing the piano. You remember a little bit about it, even though you don't practice. So I learned primary flight training there. And because I had had that training in Mitchell, I got through primary training at the head of my class. I rated first and everything. Then I went to basic training at Coffeyville, Kansas. Bob Dole tells me that's when I first started following him around, when I got to Coffeyville. That was a bigger radio engine and much more power. And that's where I saw the first cadet killed. He was taking off just ahead of me, and he pulled up a little bit too fast. He stalled and banged back into the runway, and the plane exploded. By the time they got him out of here, he was as red as a beet. There wasn't a part of his body that wasn't burned. He died right there on the field. Then I went on to advanced training, and we flew in two different planes there, the AT-9 and the AT-17. And that was a twin engine plane. The only people that went there were the ones who wanted to become bomber pilots. The others went to single engine advanced school in AT-6s. But I enjoyed that flight too, and we learned how to fly in formation. We learned how to take off and land at night, do things we hadn't done before. And then we got sent to B-24 transition school. I was sent to Liberal, Kansas. And I looked, we reported the first day to find out who our instructor was. Each instructor had four students. And I saw a name there with my name under the instructor. It didn't particularly mean anything, but the instructor's name was Ray, and then my name, and a guy by the name of Felzine, and a couple of others. The same guy that talked me into flight training at Dakota Wesleyan, Norman Ray, from Custer, South Dakota. I couldn't believe it. You know, out of all the Air Force, I end up with a Dakota Wesleyan grad of mine who was the first person to teach me how, and boy was he tough on me.
I was going to say, he didn't cut you any slack.
He didn't cut me any slack. After we flew for a while in Liberal, Kansas, He took the plane for a while and made a lot of turns and climbing, and then he turned it over to me and he says, take me back to the base. And I said, I had to call him Lieutenant because he was my instructor. I said, Lieutenant, I don't think I know how to get back to that base. He says, you find that base in 10 minutes or you're going to wash out of flying. This will be your last day in the Army Air Corps. I was scared to death. And all of a sudden, I thought about the radio compass. And I remembered the instruction on that. So I engaged that and tuned into the right frequency. And it pointed a heading that I should fly. And I got to the base about 2 minutes ahead of his 10 minutes. But he later told Elner, he said, George couldn't understand why I was so tough on him. It was because with him, as an old friend, I wanted to keep him alive.
The B-24 was a handful, and particularly a left arm full. Talk about flying that plane and what made it so difficult.
Well, it was a marvelous airplane in many respects. It would fly further, faster, with a bigger bomb load than the B-17 or any other bomber that we had at that time. But it was built like a Mack truck. It was very difficult physically to horse that plane around. It had no hydraulic controls. It was like driving a truck without power steering, heavily loaded. So you were exhausted at the end of a mission in one of those planes. I don't care who you were. I saw all American football players that had to be lifted out of the cockpit at the end of a mission. On those missions, they would call us about 4 o'clock in the morning, and we'd get dressed and get out of our tent and head for the briefing room, and usually take off after a briefing and breakfast. And so we'd take off usually around 7:30 or 8 o'clock, and then you might fly 8 or 9, 10 hours in tight formation, all the way to the target, all the way back. There was no heat in the airplane, and at 25,000 feet where we flew, the temperatures on an average day was 50 degrees below zero. There was no pressurization. You were on oxygen as soon as you got to 10,000 feet. So you had an oxygen mask here, goggles here, sheepskin lined helmet here. Your entire head was encased, and what kept you alive were the sheepskin-lined leather suits that went from your boots to your head, and they had small wires through those that you could plug into, and that's what kept us from freezing to death. But that plane, the two big, what we call the waist windows in the back, where the waist gunners were, those windows were never closed. So you're flying at 300 miles an hour in 50 degrees below zero weather. It was cold in that plane. There were a couple of little tubes that you were theoretically supposed to be able to urinate in. I never found one that wasn't frozen. There was no toilet facilities at all. You had a sort of a wax paper lined box if you had to do more. But that was a risk too, because you had to take that heavy clothing off, and you'd freeze. It was very cold, so it was a difficult plane to fly. But I, near the end of the war, they put on hydraulic controls, and that made all the difference. They were a lot easier to fly. And one thing I didn't know until Steve Ambrose wrote his book about the B-24, and especially about my crew, I didn't know that half of those B-24 bombers never made it through the war. The average crew never got beyond 17 missions before they went down. We had to fly 35 If I had known when I got to 17 that that was the average, it would have been a lot harder to fly the remaining 18, because you saw people getting knocked down every day, planes blowing up and all that sort of thing. But I can tell you this truthfully, I never had a day when I wasn't glad I was there, because I believed in what we were doing.
Well, let's talk about there. Training took over a year, and you traveled with your crew to Norfolk, Virginia. Some 4,000 other soldiers and airmen like yourself, on a boat, and a few weeks later, you're in Italy. What was that arrival like?
Well, we came into Naples Harbor, one of the most beautiful seaports in the world. It was a beautiful day in late August or early September. I'm not quite sure. My memory may be a little off on that. But as we pulled into that docking area, you could see what appeared to be several hundred children who were lined on either side of the docking area, and they were yelling at us. And as we got a little closer, you could hear them saying in broken English, "Hey Joe, Hershey bars, Babe Ruth, Butterfingers." And at that point, the captain of the ship broke in. He said, "Do not throw anything to those children on shore. This is wartime Italy. Those kids are on the edge of starvation. Yesterday, an American troop ship came in here, and the GIs started throwing gum and candy and other things. And the children jumped into the water to get at the ones that fell short of the dock, and 25 of them drowned, struggling for that. So that was my introduction to wartime Italy. Italy today is probably the best-fed country in the world. You have to work hard to find a bad restaurant in Italy. But, not so in World War II.
What about those early days when you were there? And although you were a pilot and in charge of a crew, your flight career began as a co-pilot. Can you tell us about that?
Well, every pilot that went into combat, bomber pilots, every one of them had to fly the first five missions as a co-pilot with an experienced crew that had been there for several months. I was assigned to Howard Serbeck of Seattle, Washington. He was a marvelous pilot. And so I flew the first five missions without my crew, but flying with his crew. My crew was really nervous about me being five missions ahead of them, because they didn't want to be left there after I went home after 35 missions. So my navigator, Sam Adams, he volunteered when some navigator on another crew was sick or for some reason or other wasn't flying. And if I wasn't flying that day, he'd volunteer. The second day, he was shot down and killed. We never saw him again. But that 5 days as a co-pilot was very valuable to me. I learned a lot, and to this day I feel indebted to Howard Serbeck. He's long since dead, but I remembered him for years.
In Wild Blue, in reading through about those early experiences when you began to fly from Italy, not only did you have the opportunity to learn from a co-pilot, but you tried to pick the brain of other pilots on the base too, learn as much as you could.
I did. I'd go over to the club at night or on weekends, and I would ask questions, everything I could think of I would raise. And sometimes those answers came back to me under conditions that made it very valuable. I think it probably saved our life, not only my life, but the life of my crew, since they were all dependent on me.
How did that relationship change with your crew from training to now being in combat, getting ready to fly?
Well, I had an excellent crew. I suppose every pilot thinks that, but I had very good people, and I demanded a lot from them. I never took any excuses for anything I asked them to do. I always tried to be fair, but I had complete faith in that crew, and they did in me, I might add. I don't say that boastfully, that's just a fact of life. My engineer, the 33-year-old guy I mentioned, he was the first one to kind of crack up on us. He just couldn't take the pressure. It's not any fault of his, but the I looked around one day and he was standing between the co-pilot and me, and he looked like the face of almost of a dead man. He was just frightened to death. His hands were trembling. And I saw him later that night and I said, "Mike, what happened up there today?" He said, "Sir, I just don't know whether I can take this any longer." So I sent him in to see the flight doctor the next day, and he grounded him for a while. But I don't criticize him for that. You know, the human mind and the human emotional structure sometimes cracks on all of us, and it just happened to hit him at a crucial time in the life of the war.
You were flying the Dakota Queen.
The Dakota Queen. I'm very, you know how we got that name. That was named after Elner. But I'm very proud that Ellsworth Air Force Base named one of those B-1 bombers out there the Dakota Queen. And they had Elner and I come for the ceremony, and the commanding officer said that's the plane that he flies when he takes over one of the... So I've always been appreciative. This is a great air base here, and wonderful people out there, and so I'm very proud of that. And I'm saying that so is Eleanor. She never said much, but I'm sure she was very proud of it.
Can you tell us, do you remember that first mission as a crew? The feeling and the mission itself?
You know, I felt totally confident on that mission, and it wasn't particularly difficult. We weren't attacked by fighter planes, and we weren't hit by anti-aircraft there. And I thought, you know, gee, this isn't going to be bad. I've already got 6 missions in, 5 as a co-pilot, but that counted the same. And this isn't going to be bad. The next day, a piece of shrapnel came through the windshield. It must have been roughly that big around. All jagged, red-hot metal, and it came right through the middle of that windshield. It smashed a steel girder between the co-pilot and me. It missed him about 6 inches on this side, and me about. But that would have, if that had been 6 inches to the left, it would have torn my head off. 6 inches to the right, it would have killed the co-pilot. I knew then that those bursts of flak were not playthings.
It was very interesting the way you described in the book why the B-24 and heavy bombers would fly in formation and how the Axis would try to defend in that formation with flak, mm-hmm. in the box, you called mm-hmm. it.
Yeah, we flew in formation. That began at a time when its primary purpose was to head off fighter planes, attacking fighter planes, because it was in a diamond like this, you know, back, big diamond, 28 planes in a diamond, and it was very hard on a fighter pilot to attack one of those because you had guns out of every window and the nose and the tails and the ball turrets above and the ball turrets below. So that was the purpose of that. After our bombing of their oil refineries grounded most of the German Air Force, then the big problem was the anti-aircraft gun. And believe me, the Germans were really checked out on that 88 anti-aircraft gun. What they did later in the war, and I went through some of this, they did what was called a box-type defense of the target. And they would have maybe several hundred anti-aircraft guns shooting into a box that was roughly 2,000 feet across the side and 2,000 feet deep. And that was calibrated to be about right where the bombers were. They could calibrate our altitude very easily. So when you flew into something like that, you wouldn't see how you could get through. It was just solid black. They just kept firing all the time, and each gun fired in a different circle. It was terrifying. The only thing that made a little variety from the black were these flashes of bright red when the shell would explode, and then you'd see that red thing and it's in the smoke and everything. It was a terrifying thing to fly into. I went into two of those, and I don't know to this day how we got out. It had to be sheer luck. I remember once we had a major who was leading our group, and I won't mention the target, but we came into an oil refinery, and there was one of those boxes there, just all over 2,000 feet high, and you had to go through there to get over the target. So we're approaching that thing, and I remember saying to Bill Rounds, "I don't know, Bill, this may be our last mission." He says, "Isn't that something?" He said, at this point, without any chatter, the lead plane, the major, made a sweeping right-hand turn, turned away from the target. We all dumped our bombs out, dropping on his signal. We all dropped our bombs in an empty field. That was about 2 weeks before the end of the war. He knew that war was going to end in a couple of weeks. I've never talked to him about it. I can only tell you this, not one pilot ever reported him, including me, because we all thought we'd be dead if we went into that thing, and I think that's what he thought. And he figured, I got all these young kids up here. He was an old guy, I think 38, 39 years old, I learned later he had children, and I think he figured, I got all these young guys up here, this war's gonna end anyway in a couple of years. What have we accomplished? We knocked out another oil refinery, they haven't got any oil now. I'm sure that's what was going on in his head. Anyway, to this day, nobody on that mission has ever reported that major. I think it was all because we were all glad to be alive.
December 1944 was a difficult time, the Battle of the Bulge. But at the same time, you lost your father and didn't hear about it for 10 days.
Yeah. Well, yes, the adjutant and the chaplain came to my tent one day and told me my dad had died. He was out hunting pheasants. He loved to hunt pheasants. And he was with a friend of mine, Eddie Kendall, from Ethan, South Dakota. And they spotted a flock of roosters, pheasants, just off the road a little bit. And my dad got out and went over this barbed wire fence and shot a rooster on the fly and brought it back to the car, dropped it in the back seat, and he sat down. He says, "Oh, Eddie," and he was dead. That's the way it happened.
You learned of that on December 14th, yet you flew the next day.
I did. They told me I didn't have to fly, and I said, "Look, I want to get home."
Tell us about the code that you would send in letters to Eleanor. There was a little code.
Well, I would write a sort of a meaningless date. It just had no real meaning, like February 23rd. And that would mean I'd flown 23 missions. We weren't supposed to do that, but I kept her occupied. She'd see pictures every once in a while of a B-24 bomber. There was one in Newsweek magazine that particularly disturbed her. It showed a direct hit on that plane, then the plane just split in two and spilled all the guys out into the air. And she'd see those things. She wouldn't talk to me about it during the war, but later she told me how difficult that was. And so when she saw that number getting higher. Maybe the next time I'd say January 27. And finally got up to 35, and then she knew it was all over.
There's an interesting story about March 1945. You were on a mission to Weiner Neustadt, and everything was going according to plan, except when bombs away, one was stuck in the bomb bay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had 10 500-pound bombs that day, which is sort of a standard load. We'd either have 10 500-pounders or maybe 5 1,000-pounders. And the crew called up to me and said nine of the bombs fell, but the other one seems to be jammed in the bomb rack. And I said, well, you guys got to get rid of that. I'm not going to land this plane with a loose bomb dangling around. You've got to get rid of it one way or the other. So they got out on that catwalk, which is something of a daring thing to do. It's about that wide, and you're looking down 25,000 feet. And they couldn't shut the bomb bay doors because if the bomb came loose, they wanted to go. So they kept working with it, tugging with it, and I came down from altitude so they could get off oxygen. And we're down to about 10,000 feet, and it broke loose. And I looked at my watch, it was exactly 12 noon. And that bomb, which the first one I ever saw falling, the rest was too difficult at high altitude, but it went right into the middle of a little Austrian farmyard. And I felt terrible. I know that farmers the world around usually have lunch around noon. And I figured, you know, here we are, safe and sound from a mission, and these people that thought they were safely out of the war zone in that part of Austria, and we probably wiped out a family. And that's the way I felt. 40 years later, 1985, I was a guest lecturer in American history at the University of Innsbruck in Austria, and Steve Ambrose was there. He was lecturing too. I was on television, and this young woman who was interviewing me, she said, Senator, you've dropped a lot of bombs on our country in World War II. Do you have any regrets about bombing cities like Innsbruck and Salzburg and these other lovely cities, Vienna? I said, well, war is a terrible thing. We never ought to enter it without being absolutely sure. There's no other reasonable opportunity, but I believed in World War II. I thought we had to be involved in it. And you people had thrown in your lot with Hitler, so we had to hit you, same as we did Germany. But I regret this one incident, and then I told it to her about this farmyard that we had blown up. That night about midnight, an elderly Austrian farmer called the television station, and he said, I wish you would tell the American senator who was on television tonight that was my I couldn't believe this 40 years later. It's amazing either one of us was still alive. But anyway, he went on to say, he said, I know the senator said we threw in with Hitler, and that's true with most of my neighbors, but I hated Adolf Hitler. And he said, I got my wife and three children out of the house. We saw this lone bomber coming. It had dropped out of the formation that was up higher, just this one bomber, but I got my family in a ditch, and none of us were hurt. He said, my daughter went to the University of Berlin, and my son is attending another university, and we're all doing fine. So tell the senator if bombing my farm ended this war 1 minute earlier, it's okay. So at long last, I got redemption.
But what you need to tell us is how bad that you felt about the bomb falling in that farmyard that day, the news that you received when you landed.
Yeah, I got back that day to the base in Italy, and they gave me a cable that Eleanor had given birth to our first daughter. And that thought went through my head that you just mentioned, that, gosh, here we bring a new child into the world and we're all excited about that. And I just killed somebody else's.
We're going to give the audience a chance to ask some questions in just a moment, but why don't you tell us quickly about the Magic 35th mission. Do you remember the last mission?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I hated that target, Linz, Austria. I'd been there before, and it was heavily defended. It was Hitler's hometown. That's where he was born. That's where he grew up as a boy, Linz, Austria, L-I-N-Z. So on my last mission, they told me I was going back to Linz. I just couldn't believe it. Anyway, I didn't say anything, but the colonel who was going to lead, but he says, George, you don't have to do this raid. This is your last one. And if you prefer not to fly today, you can fly another mission later on. Well, foolishly, I said, well, no, I think I should take my turn. So we get over the target, and it was incredible. I've never seen so many anti-aircraft guns in one place. What the Germans were doing, the Russians were driving them back out of Russia, but they were pulling the anti-aircraft guns with them. General Patton and the Americans were pushing them from the west, and they were pulling the guns back. So they had them pretty well concentrated by the end of the war. I don't know how we got through there. When we landed, we had 110 holes in that plane. Pieces of flak, you know. Some of them as big as your fist, some of them a baseball, some of them a golf ball. Some of them you could throw a cat through. And they knocked out our hydraulic system, our brakes, our flaps, our landing gear, everything that operated on hydraulics. We lost two engines from damage over the target, and one of them we couldn't get the prop feathered. You know, when you feather a prop turns like this. When you feather it, you turn it like that, so that there's not much drag. It's just, it's cutting like that instead of, and we couldn't feather it. We too much oil pressure had been lost. So we're flying with one engine out and one prop feathering, and then it got on fire. And I remembered from one of those conversations I had with an older pilot that once a fire begins in the engine of a B-24, you've got 5 minutes before it burns through a 3/4-inch steel firewall that protects the gas tanks from the fire. You got 5 minutes, and then it blows everything. So I'm looking at my watch here and trying to figure out what to do. I finally decided to dive. Nobody told me to do that, but I decided to dive, and I'll be darned if that didn't blow out the fire, the speed. So we got the fire out, but then what do you do when you get back to the base? I called the base tower, and they said, well, you've got three options. You can bail out, and if you do that, we suggest you go out near the Adriatic Sea, not over the water, but the beaches along. Point the plane out to sea and then bail out. Or you can try to land it without any hydraulics or anything. While I was going back home, by just sheer labor and guts and muscle, they had cranked the landing gear down manually. So when I heard that, I decided to do something else that an older pilot had told me, and that is to hook two parachutes on the girders that support the waist guns in the rear of the plane, to hook those parachutes to those two steel girders, and then as we hit the ground, throw the parachute out through the waist windows and pull the ripcord so it'll flare up. I didn't make a particularly good landing that day because I didn't want to take a chance on coming in short. I knew we didn't have the power to climb out of that, so I came in, as the Air Force would say, too hot. We hit the end of the runway, but at far too high a speed. But those parachutes really worked. They really pulled it to a slow speed. We rolled into a ditch at the end of the runway. One of our guys was hit over the target. He had a piece of shrapnel that went in right here in his leg, traveled up his leg, clear up to the buttocks, and lodged there. He was in terrible pain. So we had him, we had another guy with a broken ankle, but we got on the ground and the fire engines were out there and the ambulance and everything. That was my last mission. The war ended the next day. Hmm. So I'd have been through anyway. I should have opted not to fly that mission.
I want to remind our audience members, if you have a question, we have some microphones on the side, and if you could go to one of the microphones, then everyone who's watching this would also be able to hear it too.
Folks, hear us okay out there? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you can step up to a microphone on either side. I guess the Dakota Queen had a good pilot that day.
Oh, lucky one anyway.
Yes, sir.
Senator McGovern?
Yes.
I just wanted to ask a two-part question. One is, do you think if we had CNN and Fox News covering World War II, what do you think the impact of that type of coverage would have had in World War II? And then about the notion that probably World War II is the last war that will be, you know, clearly something that had a right reason to be fought. The rest of the wars that we've been in since then, I would put Korea, Vietnam, Desert Storm, and Iraq in that basket. I have, you know, various components of whether they're right or wrong.
Mm-hmm. I think, just to make one example, I think Desert Storm, which President Bush Sr. Directed, was probably justified. After all, Saddam Hussein had nakedly invaded another country, a little neighboring Arab state, Kuwait. And so I wish that we had exercised as much caution, though, in this war we're in now as President Bush Sr. did. He didn't do a thing until he consulted with the Congress thoroughly, went to the United Nations, got the approval of the whole United Nations, went to Europe, got European Community behind.
He was
behind.
A bomber pilot like you.
Yeah, he was a pilot, and he knew what we were up against. You know, we even had Switzerland participating. They always stay neutral, but in this war they were with us. The same with Sweden. Israel was with us, all the Arab states. So I think the Gulf War, which incidentally I supported, that was directed by President Bush Sr., was justified. It was over in a hurry. We knew what we had to do, and we sent the Iraqi army and their leader back home in short order. But we had the whole world with us. This war, almost nobody's with us. And 70% of the American people are now telling pollsters they think it was a mistake, which of course is, I think you folks know, is my view. I didn't think Iraq was the slightest threat to us. They had nothing to do with the 9/11 attack. That was Al-Qaeda. Israel wasn't high on the list of terrorist nations. but we've converted the place into a terrorist recruiting ground. Al-Qaeda's in there now. They never had any operation there until we sent our army into Iraq. So my heart bleeds for these young men we have. They're as good an army as we've ever sent overseas, and they're as well equipped, but they're on an impossible mission. I read in the Rapid City Journal today a summary on the president's speech, which I was unable to see because of another engagement, but the headline is, it quotes President Bush as saying, "It's never too late to support our troops." Well, I agree with that. And the best way to support them is to bring them back to the United States. And if we answer the rest of your question, how would we have done if we'd had CNN and Fox TV? I don't know that it would have made that much difference in World War II, because every American believed in that war. I never ran into a dissenter, either overseas or back here. My dad and mother were strongly against war of any kind, but not that war.
Senator, we have another question over here.
Maybe a follow-up, Senator. We had our embedded journalist in CNN, ABC, and some of the finest journalists in the world were some of the greatest cheerleaders. I'm thinking, not necessarily a fine journalist, I happen to have trained him in the Peace Corps, Chris Matthews, but he was a real cheerleader for the war, and now he's really turned against it. To what degree do you think the embedded journalists, the modern media, was a drumbeat for this war?
I think they were. I think the press in the early stages, almost without exception, went along with it. There were some exceptions. You had certain columnists, you had certain editors, you had a few television people, but most of them, as you said, were cheerleaders for the war. And that's true with most of the members of Congress. Most of them went along with it in the early stages. I admire this fellow John Edwards from North Carolina, whom I've never met, but running for the presidential nomination. He made his announcement that he was going to run for president saying, "I made a mistake supporting the war in Iraq, and I have nobody to blame for that but myself." That takes guts. When's the last time you heard a nationally known politician say, "I made a mistake"? I've made a lot of them.
If there are more questions, the mics are available. When you think back on those experiences, if you were 19 to 22 years old in World War II, the responsibility and the fact that you ate breakfast with some men who didn't come back that day, are there things about that time that shaped your life and views?
Well, I think that's when I learned the basic reasons why a great country like the United States should not hesitate to intervene in an international crisis. As I told you earlier tonight, I was for that when I was in high school. I was impatient with how slow we were. So I learned that there are times. I also learned that we had leaders who could inspire us and who could lift us to new heights. Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt were incredible. You'd listen to one of those fireside speeches and you were all ready to go. I haven't experienced that in any other war. I don't mean that everything was bad about these other wars, but there's been nothing in my lifetime that had the public support and the clarity of vision of what we were trying to do that was as strong as it was in World War II. You remember even the Korean War, which President Truman took us into. That was June 30th, 1950. And 2 years later, we had a presidential race. We'd only been in there about 18 months. And General Eisenhower was the Republican candidate running against Adlai Stevenson. And President Eisenhower took to the airwaves one night and said, if I'm elected president, I'm going to go to Korea and put an end to this conflict, which he did, to the praise of two-thirds of the American public. I voted for Stevenson, but I had to say that I think General Eisenhower was right about that. I think if we'd have stayed in there much longer, we might have gotten entangled in a war with China. And you folks know my views on Vietnam and Iraq. There's no point going over that. I'd only put it this way in summary. My views on Iraq are similar to President Bush Sr., his Secretary of State, Jim Baker, and his National Security Advisor, General Scowcroft, all three of whom opposed this invasion of Iraq. So if that makes me a radical, I stand with President Bush Sr., Secretary Baker, and General Scowcroft, which isn't bad company.
Senator, thank you for your service. Thank you for being our guest tonight. We appreciate it very much. Senator George McGovern.
Thank you for coming.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would, the senator will be joining us in the gallery. Please spend some time. Visit with the senator. He will be signing books, and enjoy yourself with the coffee and desserts. Thank you for coming this evening. Absolutely, Senator.
I'd like to say a word about these books that I'm going to be signing. They're a book that Random House published after my run for the presidency, and what they are the principal speeches I made in that campaign. And the reason I brought those particular books tonight is not only are they now collector's items, but in addition to that, I was reading this book a couple of weeks ago, and they're so relevant to today, you won't be able to believe it. You'd think that when I was talking about the Vietnam War, you could put the same lines in what's going on today in Iraq, the same rhetoric. And there's a lot of other things in there I think you'll find of interest. I've always thought the United States should build the best, the fastest, the safest, the cleanest railway system in the world. And you have to be careful about where you put it and how it's done. But that's what I was saying in 72. I still say it today. I wish we had a system like that. We're the only great industrial country in the world that doesn't have a first-rate passenger and freight rail system. We really need that. Anyway, these are the books I brought tonight. And even though it's 35 years old, I'm very proud of that book. And by the way, any proceeds from it don't go to me. They go to the Terry McGovern Foundation on Alcoholism.
fiction, and we're going to make television. We have an extraordinary staff at South Dakota Public Broadcasting. You see a few of the gentlemen here. We have a truck out back. There are many more out there. It's the same staff that we go to basketball tournaments with, we go to jazz concerts with, and we're very pleased to be here tonight for this special evening with a special guest and a very special introduction to that guest. Would you welcome Matt R. McGovern?
I want to thank you all for coming out tonight to support South Dakota Public Broadcasting. And I want to thank South Dakota Public Broadcasting for inviting me to be a part of this event tonight, especially Teresa Spencer, who called me one afternoon when I was at work and I was in the middle of something really busy. And she said, "Hi, this is Teresa from Friends of South Dakota Public Broadcasting." So I immediately tried to get rid of her because I thought it was a fundraising call. And so just let that be a lesson to you. Be nice to these people when they call you. They're doing great things for South Dakota, like putting on these programs tonight and the programming that this event is about, Ken Burns' new documentary, The War. And so a lot of times people ask me, what's it like to be related to Senator McGovern? What's it like to be the grandson of someone who's accomplished so much, someone who was elected to Congress, someone who was a war hero, someone who was served to represent South Dakota in the U.S. Senate, ran for president, all these great things. And I always say, well, we're really proud of all those things, but to us, he's just Grandpa George. And so we were really lucky. Even if he had not accomplished all these things, we'd be really lucky because of the type of people that my grandparents are and were. We always enjoyed going to visit them so much in Washington, D.C. when I was growing up. We would do all the same things that any other family would do. We'd, Grandpa George would take us to the zoo, or we'd go to movies. We'd go, have these big family meals where Grandma Eleanor would be cooking Thanksgiving dinner and we'd be watching a football game. So all those kind of things that any family would do. And they would both talk about the old days, both my grandparents would. And Grandpa George would talk a lot about growing up in Mitchell, being on the debate team in high school, or what it was like to meet my grandma when they were both freshmen at DWU. And they'd talk about hard times in the 30s when everybody was struggling economically. The whole country was in the Great Depression. So he'd talk a lot about the old days, and we'd love hearing those stories about the good times and the bad. But one thing that was really hard to get him to do would be to talk about World War II. And that was not something that he did very often. And most of the stories that I heard about his accomplishments in World War II, I heard secondhand through my mom or my dad, and I heard more of them a couple years ago when Stephen Ambrose wrote the book about him called Wild Blue. So, I didn't really get it when I was a kid, because you watch these movies and these documentaries and it looks really exciting and cool, all this stuff that went on back then. And it would look like he would have a lot to brag about. And so it didn't make sense to me why he wouldn't talk more about these things. And of course, as I got older, I understood a little better that for him to be telling these stories, he'd have to be talking about times that he was almost killed, or times that good friends of his were killed, or times that they had a successful mission, which meant a lot of people on the ground got killed. And it was just part of doing the job of defeating the Nazis. So I can see now why he wouldn't want to talk about these things so much, especially to a little kid. So we're all really lucky tonight to be able to hear these stories. And you all are probably going to hear some things that even people in my family haven't heard too much about. So we're all really lucky tonight. And so, Grandpa, we're going to introduce you. Usually you have these great titles, either Senator or Lieutenant or Congressman. But tonight, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to introduce Grandpa George.
Couldn't have been better. Thanks, Matthew. Thank you.
Senator, thank you for being our guest here this evening.
Well, it's my pleasure. As my grandson said a moment ago, we're all in the debt of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I've enjoyed it for so many years. You didn't ask me to make a plug, but I do it out of admiration and genuine appreciation for the high quality of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. It's an objective and fair source of the news. It sets cultural standards that are at the top.